Well, let's get started. We've had 12 lectures so far, and up to now we haven't dealt with the third dimension at all. We've dealt entirely with maps being spread out in X and Y, in latitude and longitude. We haven't really begun to think about extruding up into the third dimension. That's really louder than usual, isn't it? Let's go down a little bit. So today we're going to start talking about terrain. I've actually got three lectures on terrain, so this will go up till and beyond Friday's midterm test. Okay, I got a request to put a new version of the practice test on the site, which I did with the answers on it. Having reviewed it, I think that's probably harder than the one you're going to get, and some of the material's a little bit old, so it relies more on the book than on my lecture notes. So I would encourage you to look at the lecture notes in addition to the book. Okay, a quick history of dealing with third dimensional maps. If we go back, actually not very far historically, terrain was dealt with in a rather primitive way. On the left-hand side here is the 15th century Catalan Atlas, very sort of landmark early map of the world. And we can see the Atlas Mountains of Morocco in North Africa as a sort of, I don't know, what would you call it, like an orange ribbon or something like that. And this is barely showing the fact these are mountains at all. If we look at early maps of the Americas on the right-hand side here, back pre the colonial period, going back to, say, the 16th, 17th centuries, you see that the most complex representations of the topography is simply to put something that looks like a side view or a picture profile view of a mountain in here. Notice the towns in here look remarkably like the way they're symbolized in Europe, or the older towns here. So it's not until the, generally speaking, the, oh, go away. It's generally not until the 19th century that we begin to see maps with sort of any other means of depiction of terrain in a broad sense. Here's an atlas map from the 19th century of Bosnia-Herzegovina area, and you see that most of the topography here is just simply a set of hatch marks or lines drawn to show generally where steeper terrain is. Not really depicting the mountains in any kind of detail at all, but just sort of showing generally speaking where they are. Now, this technique of hachures, or hatch marks, was taken to a fine art. If we take a look at some of the alternative methods on the right-hand side, you can see lines just sort of vaguely going from high ground to low ground, and these were often done completely subjectively. Ridges, long ridges, and made them look like worms with hairs, so we often call these things woolly worms on the older maps. They begin to get some element of refinement when you add break lines. So here you can see that we're getting at least some form lines being associated with the hachures. Again, this is in the 18th century. And then on the left, we see this taken to a fine art with the U.S. Geological Survey producing its map of, I believe this is Mount Shasta here in California, where the techniques are being used in lots of different ways, but not always totally objective. So you can see that this sort of looks three-dimensional, but not quite. And if you look at it, some areas that should be peaks are being shown as troughs or depressions. Now, the only thing we've examined in depth so far with related to topography has been the benchmarks, or the systems of benchmarks that are shown on maps. And sure enough, the National Geodetic Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey conduct and maintain a network of fixed points in the landscape with their elevations. Many of these bronze markers are now lost, unfortunately. But normally they would have that X with a triangle in the middle at the center. That's the precise point that was used for survey. And this one actually records the elevation that was measured, 717 feet. And dates it, obviously, because the height is going to be related to the datum that's used for mapping at that time. And then these get reported back and become records in a database that you can get for the entire country. Many of these are marked permanently on the maps, but a lot of them are not. Because there's a whole series of ways that if we go to the legend and look at it, we can see that control elevations are marked. Basically, they differ between horizontal and vertical control monuments that are marked permanently, such as a section corner, where they've actually gone out into the landscape and put set a benchmark, and now that point has become a fixed reference point. It's got that triangle with a dot in the middle, means that it's fixed on the ground. Either the location or the location and elevation have been measured very precisely. The technique used for measuring elevations is a little bit different for measuring positions. It's a technique called leveling. I won't go into it in a huge amount of detail, but we'll see it a little bit in the next lecture. And a large number of those benchmarks are associated often with extremes of the elevation, bottom of Death Valley, the high point of a mountain, but then sometimes also with construction. So you'll find a lot of benchmarks associated with, say, a railroad being cut through the mountains, where they have to set the level very accurately along the lines. When these were taken over by more sort of temporary measurement techniques, you got a lot of what are called spot heights, which are often used for fixing elevations on aerial photography. And we're going to look at that a little bit later on in the quarter. So a spot height, or just simply an X with an elevation, or sometimes just the elevation itself appearing on the landscape, very often associated with roads, railways, or trails, and that sort of thing. But of course, having elevation at points is not really enough, and drawing it with lines, like Hashier lines, again, it's also not really enough. We'd like to serve the function of being objective or scientific about depicting the third dimension on cartographic maps. But here we've got a sort of a quandary. If we're going to represent the terrain on the maps, we want to have some kind of visual depiction. You should be able to look at the map and see what the lay of the land is, what the topography looks like from a distance, where the mountains are and so on. But as you've seen, for cartometry, we need more accurate measurements. We need to be able to retrieve the actual elevation at a particular location with some degree of accuracy. And these two often play against each other. So if you find a very effective visual method of representation, you know, 3D, for example, it's then quite difficult to extract the exact elevation at a particular point. I've got a clicker somewhere, haven't I? Let's use this. Then the pictures are not so broken up. Okay, that brings in a little bit more history, and I put this map up here because it was the first of its kind. This is a map produced in 1701 by Sir Edmund Halley. Here he is right here, who had an interest. He was one of the astronomers royal in Britain. He, you know, held residence at the Greenwich Observatory there, and he was the first person to go out and measure the direction and distortion of direction on the compass, a declination angle that we've talked about in the current lab. And he produced this map of the Atlantic Ocean, North and South Atlantic, in which he'd taken all shipboard measurements of declination and put them together and then drew these lines through them, lines of equal compass declination, that allowed him to, or allowed anybody who was sailing to be able to figure out what the declination would be at any particular point on the land. Obviously, we now know that it also changes over time, so this is fixed in time. Now, Halley spent the rest of his career sort of obsessed with magnetism and earth magnetism. And here he is as an old man. He did most of this work when he was young, holding a picture of what's become called the hollow earth theory. He was the first person to reason that perhaps the earth's crust was a separate entity floating above a liquid center. But he went on and then thought there were several liquid and solid centers in the earth, and that they had their own atmospheres, and he speculated even their own inhabitants, which was a little bit crazy, but probably a little bit impressive that he anticipated the link between the earth's core and magnetism, which, as we now know, it's the earth's core and the fact that it mostly consists of magnetized iron compounds that leads to the earth's magnetic field. So he gave us the what's now called the isoline, a line joining points with equal value on the map. And isolines are depicted in two ways on topographic maps, and they're extremely useful. They can show contours, and they can show bathymetry, or sort of ocean contours, depths of the ocean. And they're both symbolized in pretty much exactly the same way. They use lines with break lines where the values for a contour are put in place. Those are called index contours if they have the level there. Sometimes they're approximate, sometimes they're supplementary. I'll show you some of those in a second. We have special symbolization associated with depressions. And then we have what are called intermediate contours that fill in the difference. Notice that all these symbols, at least for the land, are in brown. So we associate brown on the maps with land features, in this case topography. So what is a contour line? Well, it's quite simply a line joining points of equal elevation. As we now know, that's an equal elevation above or below some datum. So the first thing we need is to assume that heights will vary plus and minus from some level. The datum that we often use is obviously the Earth model that's used for the ellipsoid. Now, contour lines have a specific contour interval. That's the increment between the contours, between one and the next. And if we make that interval too small, we're going to have to draw an enormous number of contours on the landscape. If we make it too big, we're not going to depict very much variation within the contours on the map. So choosing the right contour interval is a bit of a challenge. The interval is the vertical distance between contours. We often think of contour lines as what you would get if you could build a 3D model of the landscape and then repeatedly slice it from one side to the other. The line that would be traced out by the slice would be the contour on the landscape. Its contour interval is going to be a function of the scale and the units. So generally speaking, we want bigger contour intervals, 20 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, when we're dealing with coarse scale maps. And we want smaller contour intervals, 10 feet, 2 meters, 5 feet, when we have more detailed maps that are going to be at scales like 1 to 24,000 and 1 to 10,000. It's also a function of units. So we've got, if you look at the sort of legacy of maps of the United States, some of them have feet, some of them have meters. Generally speaking, they use feet primarily in the areas that are low-lying, where you want a lot of detail in low-lying terrain. Obviously, 1 foot being about a third of a meter is a lot more resolution. And we also define this term, the relief, which is simply the highest elevation in any given study area, or in our case, perhaps on a particular quadrangle map, minus the lowest. So if we say there are 3,000 meters of relief, it doesn't mean the base of the map's at sea level. It means that we have a high point and a low point separated by 3,000 meters on a given particular map. Okay, some of the features of contours, we'll go over each one of these in detail. We now know that we need a contour interval. Contour interval is going to determine to a great degree the generalization. We need index contours, so somewhere on the contour lines, we're going to have to label them so that we can tell what the actual elevation values are. We're going to label them with values, and then we're often going to have more contours than we have index or labeled contours. So we're going to have to interpolate to figure out what the intermediate values are. Intermediate contours are going to be between the index contours, and they're not going to be labeled. Supplementary contours are contours that come in areas where they need more detail. So we might have a map that's at, say, a 20-foot contour interval over the entire map area, but right in the middle of it is a swamp or a delta that has very little relief associated with it. Rather than just leave it blank, we drop down to, say, 5 feet for that particular area and include more contours. These go in as dashed lines, and we call them supplementary contours. I'm going to talk a bit about depressions. Depressions are holes in the landscape, and holes in the landscape, because of the way they are symbolized on contour maps, can look identical to hills. Okay, so we have special symbolism that allows us to tell the difference between hills and valleys or depressions. In some cases, we have uncertainty associated with contour mapping. I'll go over one or two examples here. And then in the oceans, we deal with bathymetry. So we don't have contours, we have what are called isobaths, or lines of equal ocean depth. And in many cases there, isobaths have a few but very subtle differences from contours. Otherwise, the two can be used pretty much interchangeably. So here's a zoom into the, I believe this is the Dos Pueblos Quadrangle, right next to Goleta. Here we can see a little jeep trail going up to the top of a very small hill. I can tell it's a hill because I'm at 200, I believe these are feet here. Here's my index contour. Notice that it's slightly more solid. The line's thicker than the supplementary contour. Oh, sorry, the intervening contours here. So we go 200. Well, we could find out the interval, couldn't we? Here's the next solid line. It's not labeled, but it's solid, which implies that it's an index contour. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4 intervening contours. So if I've gone up 100 feet across 4 contours, the contour interval must be 20 feet in this particular case. Okay, so I can get approximate elevations from here. If this is 300, 320, 340, 360, and we can see there's this little loop here with a reported elevation at a spot height of 380. Somebody probably took the elevation at the top of the hill. They're actually points clearly higher than 380 because we actually draw the 380 contour on that. We could say that it's probably a little higher than that, but not as high as 320, because that would merit another contour. Okay, notice a couple of things here. As we go down this slope, you notice the contours are reasonably close together. And then all of a sudden we reach the bottom of the slope. There's a creek down here, and even a little water tank. And we've got some orchards, and the land flattens out. Flattens out because the distance between the contours becomes larger and larger. Then we reach the other side of the valley, and it begins to become even steeper on this side as we go up this hillside here. So basically, more contours in a small area means steeper land. Fewer means flatter land. Okay, so here's some basic contours. Notice the fact that these creeks make sort of like indentations into the contour pattern. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. So, it didn't enlarge well, sorry about that. But here we've got an index contour at 40 feet. If the contour interval is 20 feet, that would be 20. And the next one would be zero, but we're not showing zero on here. That would be sea level. But we do have more detail necessary. So what we've done is put in a supplemental contour, which we're being told here is 10 feet. So we've gone from an interval of 20 feet, dropped suddenly to 10 feet because we have an area that's relatively flat. It was swampy and unfilled at the time this map was made. This was made in 1967. Anybody recognize it? It's the lagoon, the UCSB lagoon. Here's the dorms and so on. Here's the beginnings of the campus. Looking a little bit different. I guess that's the USIN. And look at that. We've got a road across the lagoon. Still there, I assume, underneath the water. Enclosed depressions, how do we deal with those? Well, here's another very local example. Here's a 20-foot contour, here's a 40, here we've got a supplemental, it's probably a 30, and here we've got a loop that's looks like it's the next one, so that should be 20, but it simply loops back on itself. Okay, so what we've got here is not another hill, but an indentation in the landscape. Okay, so to show that it's an indentation, we put these little hatch marks, one of those remnants of our old historical styles for representing terrain. We put them pointing downhill at regular intervals around the outside of the loop and always at 90 degrees to the contour line itself. So an enclosed depression is going to show like this. And we can see we've got several here. There's this one right here, which is the overflow from Lake Los Canarios. This is actually a dam, artificially constructed. This is the overflow that occasionally fills up with water when we get a lot of rain. And here's another one in the industrial buildings out there along, this is Hollister here. Oh, sorry, that's the 101. So we've got depressed areas here that are below the levels. And here you see we've even got a temporary benchmark set up there as a little X. Okay, strange and exceptions to contours are things like vertical cliff faces. So here is a vertical cliff face. Here are the contours representing the topography. Notice that if the cliff face is any kind of significant height, and it can be significant, there's a single cliff face on the south side of Lhotse, the fourth highest mountain in the world, directly adjacent to Mount Everest, where you can fall 3,000 meters in a single pace. It's an enormous drop. When we do that, here come our little hash marks again, in this case, in which we, again, they face downhill, and they follow what's called a carrying contour. So these contours actually come together. They're carried over to here, and then they split back again once we're away from the vertical cliff. You don't see these in too many instances, but you certainly see them on quads like, you know, the Grand Canyon and that sort of thing. Okay, and now the nice thing about contours is they're lines. So we can see the map through the lines. They don't sort of take over the entire representational structure of the map. So here's Devil's Tower, Wyoming. We've got the contours associated with the peak. And we can also see, in this case, the vegetation from the air photo. And shaded relief, you can see how the relief pattern has been simulated using shading, which are now visible over the contours. So you might say, if I said visual depiction of topography and actually being able to measure it, here we're doing both, or we're trying to do both. We get a visual depiction of the mountain itself. We can see the shaded side and the illuminated side. We can see some of these creeks and valleys over here. But we can also go to any given point and figure out what the nearest contour line is and then actually get the elevation from it. So this is a real plus as far as mapping is concerned. We can do synthetic illumination. So this is purely visual. Obviously, there's not much measurement information here. On the left-hand side, we have a map in which the intensity of the grayscale, going from black, which is zero, that's the ocean, up to the whitest, which is the highest points here, and I believe this is Santa Cruz Island. Santa Rosa Island. The higher points are depicted in the brighter shades, the white, and it doesn't necessarily give us much information about the topography. We can see some of the valleys up here. But if we, for every pixel, every location in this digital model of the landscape, we can instead put an artificial sun up in the sky and then simulate how much light would reflect off of every point on the surface. And we can use this synthetic hill shading that we've calculated like this. And you see that some features like this fault line that runs across the middle of the island are a lot more visible when you do this synthetic illumination. That's exactly how this topography was shaded as well on the map. So this technique is quite popular. It's becoming used more and more within cartography. Here it is applied to bathymetry. Okay, so now we're using artificially illuminated ocean depths. Well, we've made the land completely flat. This is a fairly familiar piece of land. Here's Colloil Point, here's campus right here. We're going out, this is out towards Gaviota. We've got no data here about bathymetry because the ocean initially is not very deep. At this point, we're on the continental shelf right here, so it's just really an extension or a flooded extension of the land. And then all of a sudden, we drop off this extremely steep hillside. And you can see that here, it's so steep that there have been repeated landslides or avalanches underneath the water. Okay. Here's Colloil Point, so we're pretty much directly offshore. That's, the platform Holly's right about there. So we don't go too much further, and we go off this sudden drop-off, and we go down to some quite extraordinary depths in the Santa Barbara Channel proper. But just take a look, that's at least three landslide events. Obviously, this one probably most recent, that one the oldest. And they're relatively significant. Compare them to this one, the Gaviota landslide, which is documented. Took place in the early 1800s. This one created a tsunami that hit Gaviota that was at least 20 or 30 feet high. So you can have multiple causes of tsunamis. Usually when you get an earthquake, they trigger things like subterranean avalanches that can lead to this. But notice the enormous detail when you can map the bathymetry like this. Here again, we've got the contour lines, or the isobaths of equal depths. That's negative 800 there. But we've also got the shaded relief, and this, again, we can begin to look at and interpret and see all sorts of little tiny events, another one there, for example, including stream systems that might have evolved when the sea level was very much lower than it currently is because of the last glacial maximum. Okay, extremely common way of depicting topography, or the three-dimensional form of the landscape, is to choose a contour interval of, say, 100 feet or 500 feet, and then to fill the area between the two contours with color. Okay? We usually do it in a sequence that's highly standardized. They often start with darker greens, go through brighter greens up into yellows, and sometimes into pinks or tan color, or even purple colors for the higher elevations. So here you can see Iraq in a nutshell. It looks like we're going to be out of Iraq by the end of the year. My goodness. That headline was in the newspaper last week, and I said to my wife, you know, if that had been 5 years ago, people would be out in the streets celebrating. But it's just going to end with a whimper, it looks like. Here's the low country, enormous amount of interior water bodies around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And then you can see the Kurdish north, very much more topography associated with the landscape there. Not much topography, just a slow rise into the desert towards Saudi Arabia. We can use hypsometric tints, also sequenced to go through bathymetry. Here's an example where ocean trenches, this isn't really an island, the bottom of it's still below sea level, but it's called a seamount. We've got sort of terrain features that exist on the ocean floor, and sometimes they're rather substantial. And the tips of the volcanoes that form the Hawaiian Islands, for example, are literally just the tips of the iceberg. And these enormous seamounts underneath them that go all the way down to the bottom of a very deep ocean. So hypsometric tinting, or choosing this sequence of colors, is quite a challenge, one of the things that gives maps a very distinctive look. Here's the USGS's official, coarse scale map of the entire country. And you might say here they've taken hypsometric tinting to a sort of fine art. Here's the entire sequence. You can see it starts from dark green, goes into yellows, then browns, eventually into purples and some white, and even monochrome when it gets to the highest elevations. And here it's been enhanced by superimposing hill shading, or simulated hill shading, so we've got two pieces of information at the same time. So you might say this is a really good way of taking and putting together the visual information to depict the look of the landscape, but also some of the quantitative information, because we can at least see what elevation range we're in on here by looking over at the index here. So you can see the slow rise up to the Rocky Mountain front here as we cross the plateau. Now, over time, cartographers have developed literally hundreds of different ways of dealing with this issue of shading, or simulating shading to make it look like topography. This is the work of one of the most famous cartographers who worked in terrain ever, Eduard Imhoff, Swiss cartographer who worked from about the 60s onward, and published the first textbook that was about just simply how to deal with terrain representation on maps. For anybody who doesn't know, this is the summit of Mount Everest. Here's Lhotse right there. A little further south of it is the famous Khumbu Icefall that you have to cross if you're going to climb the south face. The usual method is to go up here, past the Hillary Step, onto the summit there. I met somebody a few weeks ago who climbed Everest, I think it was 4 times. That's quite extraordinary. Here's a similar method, favored for national atlases. The Shelton shaded relief methods, and this is just quite extraordinary when you figure out that how they produce this. First, they would make plaster cast models of the landscape and literally sculpt them by hand and get all the detail in, all the topography and everything. They would then paint them with just the hypsometric colors and then some highlights, and then photograph them with lights coming out in different directions. If you do this very carefully, they can become the base maps for atlases. So this would be a base layer of topography that would then have the countries and the political details and the place names superimposed. So this is showing Turkey, and you can pretty much see the area where where the huge earthquake took place yesterday. It's up in here. Now, among the hundreds of different methods for dealing with relief shading is this one. This is called Tanaka shading, after Tanaka was a Japanese cartographer in the 1920s and 30s. And he argued that you could preserve the locations of the contours by literally preserving the lines, but then simulate the 3D effect of shading by making the lines thinner or thicker and lighter or darker. So here are some lines, for example, have been picked up in white, and these have been picked up in black. And by simply by varying the thickness of the lines, we can apply this method called Tanaka shading that is really quite effective at depicting the 3D view. Here you can see it almost looks like each contour line's been cut out and stuck onto the map to build up the layers like a wedding cake. Now, in geology, we very often prefer true 3D representations. I say true 3D because pretty much everything we've looked at so far really only deals with the uppermost form of the landscape. I call that 2.5D rather than 3D. But the idea of communicating all three dimensions is usually a problem of geology. So this diagram you often see in sort of ecology textbooks or anything about the environment. Here we've simply made a block diagram. It's as if we've cut out a piece of the earth. You can see the indentation for the rivers here. And then we've given it a three-dimensional look, but we're only looking at the uppermost surface of the landscape in this case. So what geologists are usually interested in is how do we depict the full three-dimensional structure of what we can see. This can be done by putting axes on here. This is the Loma Prieta Fault in Northern California. And then we can begin to do things like use movement or transparency to be able to show what's behind. So we can see it from multiple viewpoints and begin to make the brain think that it's seeing three dimensions in this instance. Another technique that is extremely common is the so-called fishnet perspective. And this is very simple to program or to draw. We simply set up axes. We have an X and a Y axis. And we have a vertical axis, and we take, you can imagine a profile line that goes in equal increments along the y-axis, let's say, and we just simply draw that line as if it were in 3D. So any line is like a cut-through profile of the topography. We then eliminate the parts of the lines that would not be visible. They're hidden behind the topography, so-called hidden line elimination. And that gives us something that looks a little bit more like a three-dimensional view of the topography. These typically have the topography exaggerated, so that you're seeing a lot. You know, the scale, the vertical scale, is often not the same as the horizontal scale. So 1 meter here is not the same as 1 meter here. Then we can take what's often called a realistic perspective, in which we make the three-dimensional view look as if it might look, let's say, from an aircraft or from space, although not truly, because here we're dealing with the planar geometry, and as soon as you take yourself into a spacecraft or an aircraft, you're viewing stereo geometry with sort of barrel effects and parallax and everything. So if we could flatten out the Earth and make it plane-like, we could depict the landscape. Here we've used satellite imagery, and Google Maps has added the streets for us. And this is the effect of raising the sea level up to the maximum that's expected if the thermohaline circulation breaks down, which is 7 meters. So there's 7 more meters of sea level here in Santa Barbara. Here's Highway 101. Clearly we're going to have to reroute that if we've got a beach right in the middle of it. And you can see that where each of the individual creeks are, we get quite a bit further inland, and this part, the east side of Santa Barbara, becomes basically ocean. There's the island of Montecito there. Here's an alternative where we've produced an entirely synthetic image from satellite imagery and digital terrain data. We put an artificial sky in here, and we've uniformly colored the ocean. So ocean view is not realistic. Now we can simulate the topography any way we want it. So what we've done in this case is done quite a bit of vertical exaggeration, but we've also put the Earth's curvature onto here so that the Earth curves away from the viewpoint. This is much more similar to what you would see if you were looking from a extremely high-flying aircraft. So normal aircraft is never going to get up to that altitude, but let's say a low-flying spacecraft, you might see that view. So here we are at the edge of the campus, and you can see the lagoon there. Here's Santa Barbara, the mesa right there, and this is the Santa Ynez Mountains. Okay, another means by which we can depict the three-dimensional form, but here we're not showing any of the metric form, so we can't measure these elevations, but we're purely trying to give ourselves a perception of 3D, is to actually create 3D. Okay, how do we see stereo? Well, we have two eyes, like many mammals, certainly many bipeds. We have one eye and the other separated by a little over 2 and a bit odd inches, or a little more. About 2.5 degrees of variation in terms of the view that each eye sees. So if you cover one eye and then the other one, you see that what you're actually seeing, the views are two slightly different views. They're not uniformly focused either. We're actually focused only in a relatively small spot in the middle of our vision, and the rest is much coarser, and I can't see anything beyond like about here. But in the spot that does overlap, we can put the two images together, and our brain, a huge proportion of our brain's capacity is associated with taking those two images and putting them together to see a single three-dimensional image. There are many other ways that we see depth. We'll cover a few of them right now. But one of them is the so-called anaglyphic effect, the fact that your different eyes see the object from slightly different angles, and you can piece that together to make a 3D view. So if we put the map on here twice, one focused towards the red part of the spectrum, and the other one towards the blue or sometimes the green parts of the spectrum, and I wear a pair of funky glasses like this so that I get one image in one eye and the other image in the other eye, I can look at this and wow, stereo just pops right out. That's very impressive. Yeah, pass it around. So you can only see this in the areas of very high relief or very high slopes, such as here, where the two images actually come out of superimposition. So you can actually see the two different colors on here. You can see them at the edge here artificially. And the remaining place where it's kind of flat, it looks gray, and that's not going to pop out as far as the three-dimensional form is concerned. It looks best from the front. That's why I started this at the front. One more look and then I'll... One last person, then I'll move on. There's one more stereo map to show. Oh, no. Here you go. Now, obviously, it's important which lens is which in this form of seeing 3D. So here we can take and put in the topography depicted in 3D and add the bathymetry. This is the area surrounding Monterey Bay, where they've done an enormous amount of work on looking at the coastline. And you'll see that it all sort of begins to make sense when you link the bathymetry and the topography together. You can see the effect of the continental shelf, where the material is being accreted. And you can even see, look at this, the Monterey Canyon, an actual river with meanders in it, buried there at the bottom of the ocean. It was formed clearly on land and now is flooded. So sea level is very much higher today than it used to be and seems to be changing rather rapidly. We're going to be changing certainly within the length of your lifetimes quite a bit. Here's a regular... Who's got the glasses? Take another look. Here's another quad in which the USGS has produced, in this case, I believe it's the Grand Canyon, quad in exactly the same method, anaglyphic stereo, where the two have been separated to show three dimensions. Doesn't look very impressive until you put the glasses on. Right? You seeing it? About 5% of people can't see stereo, by the way. And therefore not eligible to work for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Okay, now anaglyphic stereo is kind of out of date these days. You know, when you put those glasses on, you think of like 1960s sci-fi movies. 3D is very much in the forefront right now in Hollywood because new technologies are being developed around 3D. At the high end, I'm not talking about the low end lenses that you would buy for about $10 to go to the theater. These kinds of glasses, this is a shuttered stereo glass where you actually have miniature shutters that are digitally used to produce two different images at different times. So you're actually seeing both images from both eyes. They're being recreated individually for each eye, so you see 3D. And these are very common in so-called in virtual environments and caves, where you can see fully three-dimensional environments surround you. Sometimes not even without the glasses on, you can see some of this effect, but it's much more impressive with the glasses on. Now, we have a very impressive immersive VR space here at UCSB in the Allosphere over in the nanotechnologies building. And then we can take advantage of another effect. If I only had one eye and I wanted to get a 3D view of the classroom here, I could keep moving, okay? Because as I move, I'm getting a slightly different view of what I'm seeing, and I can, again, my brain is pretty good at taking that movement information and piecing it together to make a third dimension. So movement and stereo kind of go hand in hand. If we can put something static, in this case we've got a chunk of hill-shaded topography, and put it into a virtual environment. In this case, we've created what's called a virtual reality markup language file, or VRML file. Then we have a series of controls down here that allow us to move the object around. So we can rotate it, we can change the angle at which we're viewing it, we can come down to the landscape and move it around, we can zoom in and zoom out on it, and give the impression through movement of the third dimension. Now, Google Earth has taken advantage of this. In their software, they allow you to come down and view objects from the side. In fact, as you zoom in now on the landscape, it begins to tilt up so that you're viewing a side view rather than an overhead view. So movement depth is very common. Here's some little animations that show you that this is not enhanced. This is just the natural view, the digital orthophoto quad. It's even in black and white with a few vectors on it. But because it's moving, let me come back and make that move again. Because it's moving, your mind believes it's seeing three dimensions when it's looking at that particular object. And this one is entirely computer generated, but again, it's movement that allows you to see the detail. There's very little shading or color on that particular graphic. So movement depth is extremely important. It's one of the cues that we use to see information in three dimensions on cartography. Okay, one of the shorter lectures. Summary, we've looked today at terrain visualization. It's the first of three lectures on terrain. So we're going to look at some new techniques for terrain visualization in the next lecture. We've seen that over time we can do pictorial representation of hills, kind of like little hill profiles on maps. You look at any old ancient map, you're going to see very primitive terrain depiction. To that we move towards hachures. So originally we saw these things called woolly worms that just looked like mountain ridges on the landscape. Hachures were taken to a fine art and became very scientific in the way that they were created, but they're only ever going to be visual representations, but they've survived as remnants in the way that we depict contours on occasion. So we've looked at contours, lines joining points of equal elevation on the map, or also isobaths, lines joining equal depth on the ocean. We've seen that they have index contours and so on. That occasionally we have to do special symbols on the contour lines, for example, to show enclosed depressions. We can use colors, and the simplest form is to use colors that fill the area between contours. This is called hypsometric mapping, and we can integrate that with other forms of depiction. We can show block diagrams that allow us to see the full three-dimensional form of the landscape. We can use various shading techniques we've looked at. We can use perspective, the 3D form, and then we can show true 3D, and as we've seen, we can do that by simulating the stereoscopic effect or by using movement to depict topography. Okay, that'll do it for today, and see you all on Wednesday. Thanks.